What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day everybody, welcome back to the ESPN Footy Pod for another week. My name is Matt Walsh, Jake Michaels and Champion Data's Christian Jolly here to talk all things footy. And what a week it was. The Pies lost again, feels like an age ago. There's more concussion drama to address. Some surprise teams are winless, some surprise teams are undefeated. And there are teams we just don't know enough about yet. Jake, what's been the most surprising thing for the start of the season for you?
Well, maybe not the most surprising thing, but I guess the unpredictability of football is such a great thing. And I think the sport is in a really good place with, you know, we, at the start of the year, everyone would have said Collingwood, Brisbane, one of those two sides going to win the flag this year. Collingwood, big chance to go back-to-back. Brisbane, primed, ready to strike and make amends from last year's grand final. And you look where they are now. Things change so quickly, and that's what the first few rounds have really reiterated to me, is that things do change quickly. The teams we think are good may not necessarily be good, but then they can turn it around quickly again. So I think from that point of view, footy's in a great spot, and it gives hope to all fans.
Christian, do you get sick of getting requests of Champion Data for things like, what is the latest trend that we're going to see in your 2 or 3 weeks into a season? Teams have played 2 or 3 games. Is it really hard to kind of nail down a sense for the season ahead so early? When do you think it's sort of like the right time to kind of start to notice which the good teams are, which are the bad teams, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we preempted now, so we know the questions are coming. So we know what to look out for early in the season. I think all the media cycles sort of run the same way. But for me personally, it's probably not until the bye rounds where we've clearly got a team or 1 or 2 or 3 teams that are at the top of the ladder and we know what way they're playing and where the teams are trying to shift their game styles mid-season. Again, it's very early. I think every team's come out a little bit more focused on what they were doing pre-season and have their own plans. You see clubs start tinkering, thinking, okay, these, you know, the four top teams are actually really good at moving the ball from defensive 50 to forward 50, so we need to get better at stopping the ball movement. So there is in-season adjustments, and I feel like, yeah, probably around 12, 13 is when you can really get a feel for how is the season playing out, what are the trends that are getting higher. As I said, early days now, good weather probably, you know, changes the game style a little bit. I think everyone's sort of up and about. Even, you know, watching some of the last quarters and the cramping that happens earlier in the season and sort of the way the game slowed down, I think it's very, very different. But you got to wait till about round 13, 14. Wait till you start to see which teams are dominant, which teams are struggling, and why that they're sort of going that way.
Well, we might as well pack it up and then come back.
He's not much of an overreact. He's not going to overreact and say Team X is cooked, Team X is going to win the flag. So.
Fair enough. Heaps to get to as per usual, but before we get cracking into it, something you noticed from the weekend of footy, Jake?
Well, I was really happy with this one, and I thought this is gonna be a.
You've started well with this segment this year.
Well, I'd like to think so. Ned Reeves.
Yes.
Weird stat line when I had a look at his numbers after the game. So he had 10 disposals in the loss to the D's, but he had negative 5 meters gained. I think it was negative 5 or negative 12. I've got a lot of numbers here, and that one's not the one, unfortunately.
Yep.
And it got me thinking. What's the most amount? Like, that can't happen that often. 10 disposals. It's one thing if you get one disposal and then you go off and you've handballed it backwards or something like that. But 10 to have negative meters gained.
So a big man probably handballing behind.
Handballing a lot of the time, okay. and not, you know, taking, biting off too much. But I thought that can't happen too much. So I asked Christian and it turns out it does happen quite a bit.
Yeah, it's probably happened. if you're just looking at minimum 10 disposals and finishing with negative meters gained, there was over 200 players in player games.
That 200 rucks?
No, exactly. There was a lot of ruckmen, but no, there was a mixture of all sorts of players. And the top two was probably two defenders where they were playing in the games they played. Daniel Cross for the Bulldogs had 27 disposals, I think, for negative 5 meters gained. And Jack Watts, when he was playing in defence one day, had 27 disposals, and I think it was negative.
It was minus 38.6 meters gained, which just doesn't sound. 27 disposals, minus 38.6 metres gained. That just doesn't seem accurate. Not to question any of your numbers.
No, I said the exact same thing, and I said, what could possibly have gone wrong with this game? And there is no...
He's obviously maybe taken one on the wing and then spotted a guy in defensive 50, kicked back 50 metres, and then...
Might have been a lot of switch kicking. So as I just explained to Jake, you can be standing dead centre in the ground at centre-half back, kick it forwards based on where you are, sort of, you know, in front of you, but you've lost metres gained because you've kicked it out to the boundary line. And
so it's the line to the
middle of your goal.
Yeah.
So if you're, as I said, if you're in the centre of the ground, you might be 100 metres away from goal, kick it out to the wing, it's 105 metres. So it's
not
always
directly
turning around and turning backwards. No.
That's interesting.
So yeah, sort of not as a crow flies. It's how much metres you're
gaining.
It
does make sense, though.
Just a little quirky one on that. So there's a few Neds running around in the AFL world at the moment. So Ned McHenry is another one. And I actually noticed this, and I hadn't noticed this before, and I don't know if this is new this year or... I'm a bit slow to this, but Ned McHenry is actually Edward McHenry, and he was named as the sub on the weekend. And so when it came up with the subs, it said E. McHenry is the sub. And I'm like, I swear I've just seen his name on broadcasts and other times where it's just been N. McHenry. Has anyone else like to say anything about that?
Is that something you noticed?
No, it's not, but just because you were talking about
I didn't know that...
We notice a lot to do with name changes and databases. Yeah. That one hasn't come across for me. So we've had one this year where Jordan Butts has actually been spelled J-O-R-D-A-N.
But he's Jordan.
But now it's been changed to J-O-R-D-O-N. We checked back when he first came into the league and he was sort of submitted as a D-A-N end of his name. But now it's... So again, just... We're always playing around with names, but the Edward McHenry hasn't come across my one.
Anyway, Christian, something you noticed from the weekend of footies?
Just a little personal one, nothing sort of too groundbreaking, but just a good stat you're looking at when a team's going well and some of the fundamentals or small parts of the game, which we'll probably talk about from Craig McRae's presser. But GWS, I mean, they dominated the forward half against the Eagles, but I just noticed that one thing that stood out to me is their three leading tacklers with eight each were Toby Bedford, Brent Daniels and Harvey Thomas. So all three small forwards. Just a good thing to notice sort of when teams have gone well previously in the past, especially Richmond with Castagna and Butler almost had a pressure record, you want your small forwards buying into this pressure stuff. So as I said, a lot of the ball lived down there, but they were the three leading tacklers. And then fourth in that game was Jack Buckley, who's their fullback, who also had seven tacklers. So if you're going to have a lot of buy-in from your forwards and defenders actually putting in a lot of tackles and chasing up the field, it's going to be a good sign for things to come.
We talk about traditions in footy a lot. Last year we talked about the bounce and the centre bounce, and maybe that's sort of going the way of Dodo eventually. Well, I can't see it lasting too much longer, which is a shame to say. But there are a lot of traditions that are kind of going away, basically. But it's good to see a bit of a reversal from the West Coast Eagles on the weekend. So a few years ago, I think when Optus Stadium first came around, they stopped running through banners at home games. They were running through this giant inflatable eagle with, you know, steam and smoke and everything, and they'd run through that very American sort of NFL areas, right?
Is it a bit lame?
Well, so I've noticed that they've gone back to the banner this year. The banner is back, and they've ditched the blow-up eagle, and I think fans are broadly happy about the change. And it just goes to show that not everything sort of, you know, the Americanization of footy doesn't always work, and there's something about the banner, sort of these old traditions, bit of a dig at your opposition. Good on the Eagles for bringing it back, I reckon.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I didn't notice that, actually. I knew they were doing the big inflatable thing, the whole show that would go along with that. But I didn't know they'd gone back to the banner.
Yeah.
So you reckon since Optus Stadium was built, they haven't had a banner?
It might have been earlier, but for a number of years, they've been running through this giant inflatable eagle.
Gee, that's a good one. From you.
Thank you. Let's get into the main body of the podcast. Plenty to talk about, as we said. Swannies have started very hot. So very, very hot at 3-0. Of course, made the grand final a couple of years ago in 2022. They were beaten soundly by Geelong. Had a bit of a regression year last year. So just sort of weren't quite there. Scraped into finals. Got done by the Blues in that elimination final. And you kind of wonder about where they are. Whether they will improve again or if they'll sort of plateau at that kind of point. But they're back with a vengeance, it seems. Their weapons are more refined. They have speed. They have dare, a willingness to take the game on. The skills are really, really good early in the season. I know you talk about weather when it comes to a bit of that sort of stuff, Christian, but it looks like from the outside, not a lot has changed about how they play the game, but the quality with which they play the game has improved.
Yes, exactly that. That's sort of, I think the sort of tagline I had with Sydney is they haven't had to reinvent the wheel. That, yes, they made it to a grand final in 2022, just scraped into finals last year, but it would always put a cross next to their season compared to where they were 2022. They've come out this year looking like the best team in it with not a lot of sort of big jumps in numbers or big changes across the board. So again, we can sort of bring the game down to how you sort of work. We've got a thing that we use on Fox Footy, I think you might have seen it, Core 4, which is just looking at four parts of the game, how you go with the footy, how you go without the footy, so your defensive stuff and how you stop ball movement, how you go at the contest, so how you go at the clearance contest, and then your general play contest being the two other options. So if you look at 2022 with the footy, they were fourth best team for when they had the footy in hand, how good they were from being able to score from that. Fifth last year, so didn't go down too far. Third this year across the first three rounds, so back up.
But that's not really... Exactly. I would look at that and just say that's level. Yep.
So without the footy, fifth in 2022, fourth last year, third this year. So
incremental increases.
So the one that does stand out to me is, and it was what had dropped off a little bit last year, and we might talk a little bit further later on this podcast about game trends, and the contest part of the game is probably just falling a little bit to the wayside, and the skills are coming to the forefront in winning a game of footy, but the clearance and contest stuff for Sydney is where their improvement has helped. So 2022, at the clearances, they were the 11th best team, 13th last year. They've gone to 7th this year. And in general play, so outside of that, winning the contest, they were 6th in 2022, dropped to 12th last year. So that has a lot to do with your ball movement, because if you're trying to move the ball and you kick it to a contest, it gets spoiled. If you can come and pick up the next possession off the ground, that's your chain keeps going and it boosts up your ball movement numbers. You lose that possession and it's sort of going to struggle and the teams are going to be able to go back the other way. So they dropped to 12th last year. Back up to 7th this year. So take all four of those areas and accumulate where all your rankings are. They were 5th across all four in 2022, dropped to 8th last year, which is about where they finished on the ladder, and they're up to 2nd this year with just those slight little improvements everywhere. Some teams have dropped off in certain areas. Some teams, you know, have that saying of robbing Peter to pay Paul type things. Sydney have not had to do that. They just had to tinker, get better slightly around the contest, and you can see at the moment, proof's in the pudding of how well it's going.
The list profile is another interesting thing to me, Jake. So they're only the 8th in terms of average age. So they're sort of middle of the table in terms of their age, but they're the 5th most experienced playing group in AFL. And this is after Buddy has retired as well. Mm. So I think there has to be a bit of credit to John Longmire for sort of playing and persisting with some of the younger players. So when you first brought in a Chad Warner and Errol Goulden, these kind of guys, they weren't in and out of the team. They were playing.
And that's what you need to do with these guys, especially if they're players that you've brought in and you know that you've invested good draft capital on them and you know that these guys are going to be part of our future. You've got to let them play. You've got to let them develop. They can't be in and out of the side. You can't, you know, it's tough to do. It's tough to do when you're a good side.
Especially because for Sydney, who've always for 20 years have told us they can't tank. They can't bottom out. They can't sort of just revert back to youth for a whole year because they're just going to lose that market share. Yeah. And
they need to be really they well. They must
been
stay
able to
relevant.
Sort of, and lead these guys in while still being able to play with their experience.
The two things with Sydney that are important, and you just said one, but I'll get to that in a sec. The first thing is, we haven't seen the best of them yet. They have a number of injuries that we've spoken about.
Might have peaked too soon in terms of making a grand final a couple of years ago. But this seems more sustainable now.
Well, I think they're a better team now, clearly, than what they were 2 years ago.
Sure.
I know we're only three rounds in. But we all looked at Sydney in the off-season, and I think it was pretty universal. Everyone was saying, yep, Sydney's had the best off-season in terms of who they've brought in, how they've developed that list. So it's no surprise to see what they're doing now. What is surprising is that they've been able to do it without Luke Parker, without Callum Mills, without Taylor Adams. Mm. Now, do all of those three come back in? Question. Can they play all three of them? I tend to think they probably can, but they can't all play in the midfield. I think Heaney's proved that he must stay in the midfield. But the second point of this, which is fascinating to me, is did Buddy go a year too soon?
Oh, so you're saying, so some people are saying that Sydney's forward line looks more open and sort of more chaotic without Buddy. But you're sort of saying, well, if he'd stuck around another year, maybe they could have gone one better.
Is Buddy Franklin this year better than what Hayden McLean or Logan McDonald will be throughout this
without course of the putting year? You under the pump, but the targets inside 50 this year would be a much greater spread amongst more players compared to what it might have been in the last couple of years.
Yeah, again, because Buddy's missed a lot of games, I probably could compare it to when he's been out. But you're right; they have, clearly sort of
and the ball around and knowing targets. Knowing the age and all of that, you do have to factor in that it's probably unlikely he's going to play the full season. There may well be injuries, but Would they be a better side with him this year?
The other one that's the intangible and you can't sort of measure is the buddy factor of when I'm going forward, I've got to look for Buddy and then look for McDonald afterwards. Now they don't have that problem. So again, there's a lot of...
Maybe that's the answer.
What would you pay Buddy this year?
Maybe
the cap squeeze might have been on.
The veterans minimum. But that's it. Maybe they are better because of that reason. I don't know the answer. I'm just curious to me because a lot of the Buddy talk was, you know, it was him going to Sydney, and this is not how I feel, but it was a failure because he didn't bring premiership. Yeah. I think that's ridiculous. So you can't tell me that a Buddy, if he was playing this year, if they won and he played a very minimal part in delivering the flag, that's a success. It just doesn't add up.
Let us know on Footy Tips what you think, whether Jake has a point. We're talking about a lot of what ifs, but I guess what has for sure has changed, or not changed, but what everyone's been highlighting about the Swans is how good their foot skills have been to start the season. And some of the prime movers, you look at Blakey off halfback, Goulden obviously with the ball, Braden Campbell's a really nice left foot. There are these guys that are now being able to be so damaging with their feet and with ball in hand. And we've talked about in previous years kind of what the game trends are and how the best teams are doing it, whether it's from contest, whether it's from turnover from back 50, whether it's transition, all this kind of stuff. Can you kind of see, you know, a priority or a premium being put on good skills going forward? Because it seems like we're sort of transitioning towards a good skill set is what's going to win you games.
Yeah, and probably the numbers sort of stack up. So again, probably the easiest sort of rawest way you can look at it is just the stat, what we call stat win percentage. So you win a certain stat across game and how often do you win the game. So as I said, the last 3 years, it's 100% of the time you win points, you win the game. So if you get a high score, you win the game, which is no surprise.
Thank you for that one.
But look, 2 years ago and probably last year, the main sort of stat to win the game, to be leading it and win the game is meters gained. So just get more meters gained towards goal and just sort of gain the more territory. Contest was sort of 2 years ago, contest and contested possession was up around the 70% mark, dropped to 65% last year and dropped to 61% so far this year. But the one that's gone through the roof is just effective kicks. So if you've had more effective kicks than your opposition, we were down at 69% 2 years ago, 3 years ago, up to 74% last year and at 91% so far this year. So again, a little bit of a rider. The skills are going to probably come down as it gets wetter and the seasons change. They might get a bit lower. But early days, effective metres gained is higher than it was last year. Effective kicks is higher than it was last year. And effective short kicking as well is higher than last year. So the contest is probably going a little bit away from the good teams aren't necessarily dominating contests anymore. Break even in that area. But yeah, let's use our foot skills especially is the one that's standing up. Yep.
I think it's had a bit, that's reflected in who we view as, you know, some of the best players in the league. Going back to your 6 to 8 years ago, when contested ball was so important, the best players in the league, Patrick Dangerfield, Nat Fyfe, these kind of guys that were just in and under players, not necessarily known for their ball use.
Tom Mitchell.
Whereas now, you look at the players that we all view now as some of the best in the league. You know, Nick Dacos, Toby Green, Zach Butters. They're all amazing ball users. And I think it sounds crazy to be, oh, well, he can be the best player in the league, but he's, you know... Patrick Dangerfield, at his absolute best, was a 60% ball user, high 50s. That's just the nature of the way he played the game. Whereas you don't see it like that with some of these other guys because they're different players and they're getting more of the ball on the outside and they're hitting targets, and that's so valuable.
And the game's constructed for the Chad Warner and Eric Gordon to fly past and win on the outside.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, from one team that is undefeated to a team that hasn't yet won, it's Collingwood, the reigning premier. So
you enjoyed that, didn't you?
What do you mean?
I just thought you enjoyed that little segue.
Didn't even have it written down, would you believe? The Pies. So 0-3 heading up to Brisbane this weekend, obviously the Easter Thursday clash. Real danger of being Norton 4, which, straw poll really quickly. Season done, they're not winning the flag if they just go 0-4.
Depending on how it looks and how it goes, I think, it's... I don't think so.
I think they can make finals, but they couldn't win a flag.
It's too hard to be top four, and I think it's you've almost have to be top four.
So the question I want to pose, and there's no easy way to answer this, and for a podcast that likes to rely a little bit and delve into statistics a bit, the question I'm going to ask is going to horrify you. But what is their biggest problem? Is it the hunger? Because there's a number of, and you can quantify it kind of, but it could also be quantified by things like, you know, you're getting a bit older, you're getting a bit more.
But everyone's getting older.
Yes, but you can go over the hump, so to speak. There are players, you know, talk about Buddy, might have gone a year too far, or might not have gone far enough, but is it hunger? Is it that their key cogs are too old? I mean, I think they've got the oldest list in the competition. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Has their game style been found out? Like, what has gone wrong for Collingwood?
I think there are a couple of reasons, but the first thing, and I don't think it should be glossed over, and it's not a knock on Collingwood, it's something that we probably should look at through the other end of the telescope, is that more credit needs to be given to the teams that are able to pull off the dynasty. Richmond, Geelong, Hawthorn, Brisbane going back further. To be able to win a premiership and come back the following year, not to say Collingwood aren't hungry, of course they would rather be winning than losing.
Yes.
But to actually do it after you've had the ultimate taste of that ultimate success, it's so difficult. And I don't think the teams that can back, because we've seen every year, when Melbourne pumped the Bulldogs in 2021, we're all like, they're going to win the next two or three. And it's just like, you
think
every...
And then Geelong wins, you go, can they back it up again?
Yeah, it's just how it works. So to be able to do it, and not just back up and win again, but to win, you know, three in a row, as a couple of them did, or 3 in 4 years... Mm. is an extraordinary achievement. I don't think those achievements get enough credit.
Well,
so to that,
even with their opponent that they're playing, does it make you give more sort of credit to what Brisbane's been able to achieve for 4 years? Yes, they haven't won one, but they've been getting to prelims and giving themselves a chance every year.
Yeah.
So we always talk about dynasties and winning it, and Brisbane have been a failure, but Brisbane have been able to maintain that edge, just haven't been able to take the next step for four or 5 years. But Collingwood,
teams.
As I've said, Collingwood 2021 won finals, in 2022 they sort of got to the prelim, 2023 they won a flag. If they already drop out this year, it's a very fleeting sort of time at the top, whereas you've had Brisbane, Port Adelaide and certain teams that don't actually win it but are always part of the best teams for 6-7 years straight.
So try and quantify it for us, whether it's hunger or whether it's, you know, these players getting a little bit older. Are there things that we can look at, players that you just sort of have noticed a drop off, whatever the reason might be?
We can start player wise. So again, I think the broad thing for Collingwood is, and again, whether it's the way they're set up, the personnel they have, but teams have been able to pick them apart this year. It's the defensive numbers that have really hurt Collingwood. They were the number one sort of defensive team last year.
But is it because the defense is poor, or is it structure
everything
around the pressure?
It's everything.
The
it's easier to move the ball end to end against them. They've conceded 69 points from turnovers per game this year. That's from turnovers. That's one source. They conceded 71 points per game last year from all sources.
Yeah.
So just the turnovers is almost outscoring the way they were last year. So that's coming from back half. That's coming from your poor foot skills in your own back half, but it's also just coming from you get it down to your forward 50, can't score on the other team's able to go end-to-end and score against you. Their pressure differential, which was top two for 2 years in a row, has dropped down to the bottom, or sort of bottom eight now, but almost even. So that was another big part of their game was, we'll hunt you, but when we get the ball, we've got lots of space. They're
but
not getting that time.
Pressure's a real effort thing, right?
Yeah, and there's twofold. So you can have high-pressure teams that don't go anywhere. They put pressure on, but then they get the ball and they're getting pressured, and it's just a junkie-type game. What Collingwood had done, and I felt like they didn't actually unlock the pressure rating to be used correctly. They were sort of not worried about their own number, as long as it was higher than their opposition's number. So I don't think they went out there to aim. There's a lot of teams that might aim to get 190, 200 pressure points, and that's a tick for them across the game. I don't think Collingwood really cared about that number, as long as it was continually higher than their opposition. And it was in all but five games last year they out-pressured their opposition. They've been out-pressured in every game so far this year. So, again, defence and the way teams are playing against them has got better. But players-wise, you look at, Jordan Ngoi at the moment, second career low for ground ball, gets fewer score involvements since his debut season, just 235 metres gained per game, which is the second fewest of his career. It's his third fewest inside 50s of his career. And just, I mean, you look at his game last week, 13 disposals, two score involvements, and we just spoke about pressure.
Yeah.
Zero tackles, one inside 50. So playing the whole night in the midfield and not being able to apply a tackle.
Very ordinary. The only two players I look at this so far through three games for the Pies and say they get a tick, probably Nick Dacos and Darcy Cameron. Josh Dacos was good against the Saints, but I think Nick and Darcy Cameron are probably the only two that would give, without thinking, give ticks.
An improvement on what their output might have been. Yeah. I mean, it's, high bar for Dacos.
It is, but even him, like yes. he had the highest bar of all of them, and he's still maintained or gone to another level, whereas the others have either plateaued or gone backwards.
And they've got a number of veterans as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, speaking about Dagoe, we'll talk about Penderin side bottom in a sec. Another one that's probably a bit underrated in terms of how good he was for him last year, Jack Crisp, ended up being the number one player ratings player in the finals last year. 18.5 points across his three finals was more than Sam anyone Walsh. Else. So higher average than Sam Walsh. he's dropped to the first few rounds. He's 256th in the competition for player ratings.
Wow.
Fewest disposals since 2013. Fewest uncontested possessions since 2013.
I knew I was right to leave him off my top 50, my best 50 players heading into the season.
And then it's Penderbury and Sidebottom. And again, it's almost sound like we broke a record with the Dagoe and Crisper. The Penderbury fewest disposals since 2007, which was his second season in the comp. Fewest uncontested possessions since his debut season. Fewest score involvement since that year.
Wow.
2.7 tackles is his fewest of his career. He's always up been up about 4.5 to 5 tackles per game. But the one that stands out, as I said, fewest uncontested possessions since his debut season. 50% of his possessions are coming from a contest this year, which is the highest percentage of his career. So sometimes you look at that and you think, oh, great, in and under.
His skill set is not matched to
exactly.
that. Exactly. And at his age, he shouldn't be doing that.
Yep.
And side bottom, same. Fewest disposal since his debut season. Fewest score involvements and tackles and ground ball gets ever of his career. So, again, 320th rated player in the competition at the moment.
When I was looking at Collingwood, I mean, my takes with the Pies have been a bit all over the shop the last couple of years.
So, they've been a bit all over the shop.
Well, exactly. But I always had this worry about how are they going to score? You look at their forward line, yeah, there's some players that made a name for themselves with what they were able to do at various points of last year and even late in 2022. But as a forward six, as a unit, they're not a threatening team that you worry about. They lack that real key position player that can rip a game apart.
Brody Mychek toils away.
You're not surprised if they can only kick 65 points in a game before that reason. So when all of a sudden the points you're conceding go up dramatically, how are they going to win games of football? That's the question. You look at it now and you think, gee, can those guys that they have there turn things around? Can they get enough of a score? What's more likely to happen? They're going to have to increase their scoring or they're going to tighten up defensively?
For me, tighten up defensively. That's 69 points from turnovers. You can't cop that. You've got to get that down to competition average is about 40. So they've got to take about 30 points off that one source alone.
Yep.
But you're right. They weren't winning shootouts a lot last year. They were fifth for points for. Fifth for scoring per inside 50, but second for goal per inside 50. So accuracy really helped them. They were getting high quality shots and they were nailing them. But their forward line potency is not at the pointy end, you know, not at the top of the table.
What do they need? Like, who is the perfect player that they could just bring in now? What do the Pies need to turn this around? Is it a problem that's starting in the midfield? Because what you're saying about Penderbury, the way he's winning the ball, do they... I'm not saying they need Taylor Adams, do they need?
I was about to say that. Do they need sort of that defensive-minded midfield? Just, you know, throw a name out there, a Tom Atkins, where you just throw him in the centre bounce and your job at the centre bounce is just to tackle, just to provide, you know, just create a contest and just try to tackle so we can at least have Dagoe and Nick Dacos ball-focused and trying to win it. That midfield mix, who sort of stands out to you as being that one guy that you're going to throw in and run with a player or tag a player, who's going to lay that big tackle at Collingwood? They've got guns, they've got Sidebottom and Penderbury in that, but as you said, that's not their main go.
And so, the other thing with those two guys is it's not a shot on them. This is expected. Yeah. You know, this is what happens.
I've been saying about Penderbury, so the narrative about Penderbury and Collingwood last year was how good Collingwood were, and Penderbury was about their 10th best player last year, and no one sort of, you know, they said he was going fine, but they were doing it without Penderbury being dominant. And then what he produced in that last quarter of the grand final, everyone was saying the same thing. It was he turned back the clock. It's something we hadn't seen from Penderbury for 30 weeks was the way he played in that final quarter because he'd come back to the pack a little bit in terms of his standing at Collingwood. Now this year, I find it very, very harsh that he's copying all the blame for dropping off. So I was like, well, last year it was fine because they were winning. Ago, and his form, as I said, the numbers are lower, but he's not the reason.
Nobody went into the year thinking Scott Penderbury must be a top 10 or top 8 player for Collingwood for them to go back-to-back. He's still good enough to be playing and he can still produce at at an A-grade level when it required. He just can't do that every game.
The Pies did it very well last year in terms of they won the close games. And I think, you know, we talked about luck a bit with the Pies last year and just how they were able to sort of shut down the key moments when it really mattered late in games. And I think the overarching thing, we were having a discussion in the office before this, was you can't really luck yourself into winning a flag. You have to be good enough. But you can time it really well. And I think the timing for Collingwood has been perfect because there are these things that are not falling apart, but there are these things that weren't going to be sustainable for the long term. And good on them. They won a flag out of it.
Talk about Sydney from 2022 getting back to where they are now, and it's just slight increases across the board, nothing major. Same as Collingwood. It's just slight drop-offs across. The turnovers one is really in your face, but it's just slightly off a little bit there, here, there and everywhere. But again, back to your point, they won a lot of close games. I think I heard the stat on the weekend. They've, you know, in the last 2 years, they've been behind at three-quarter time 20 times. And they get a lot of credit because they come back and win. But it's like, hang on, stop at that sentence there. You've been behind at three-quarter time this many times in the last 2 years. It's not a great stat to have. Yeah.
Probably need to move on from the Pies.
Do they win?
No. The flag?
No, against Brisbane. The flag. Do they beat Brisbane?
No, I don't think they do. I think they get done pretty comfortably.
What's pretty comfortably? Five goals?
This is the margin tip game, so you've got to put your... I'd probably tip, 26 points I'll probably be putting Brisbane.
I think, it's the story will be Collingwood, given that they've played the extra game and they will fall to 0-4, whereas even if Brisbane lose, it's 0-3. Yeah, I would be surprised if Brisbane didn't beat them.
Look forward to you asking some hard-hitting questions in the press conference on Thursday night.
We'll look forward to it.
Hey, in the preseason, we talked about sort of an in vogue stat or a stat that you, Christian, expected to be a bit more popular this year, whether it will be on TV or on the newspapers or on radio, and it's the 100X. So the stat which ranks every player per 100 minutes played against the competition average in that position. So I guess to clarify, if you have a plus 3.2 100X rating as a midfielder, you are on average 3.2 ratings points better per 100 minutes of game time than the average midfielder. Am I saying that correctly?
Correctly. Game time in the midfield too.
Yes.
So not just all your game time, just as when you've played midfielder. So if you've played 100 minutes across the game, 70 of those were as a midfielder and 30 was as a forward. We'll take your points in that 70 minutes as a midfielder and extrapolate that to 100 points. That's your 100X rating as a midfielder of that game, but you'll also have that 100X rating as a forward in that game too.
Yes.
So we can compare everyone in all positions.
So you're extrapolating it out. And there might not be players that have played 100 minutes so far in a certain position as well. But there are... We did say we were going to keep up to date with this throughout the year.
So
Go on.
No, I was just going to say exactly that. So I've gone through and sort of very early days, so hard to make any big calls about just using this year's data. One that did stand out to me is Isaac Heaney, because everyone's sort of talking about, well, you've got to keep him in the midfield now. And I think he is the third or fourth best midfielder per 100 minutes.
But you just said in this episode earlier, you have to keep him in the midfield.
I think you do.
The best player in the competition at the moment, if you're using everyone to at least play 60 minutes in a position, the best player in the competition is Isaac Heaney as a forward.
Yes, because that's because I'm going to fight
exactly.
you on this forever. Because that's him playing as a midfielder and then going forward.
Yes, but when he's actually gone forward, he's still getting those rating points. He's still taking marks inside 50. So again, I know your debate about where he's getting it on the ground.
He's proved he needs to be around the ball more.
And I think this is the Petrarca and Heaney sort of thing. Yes, their numbers are good as a forward, so it sucks you in. Maybe we need to let him spend more time forward. But I think it is that. It's because 80% of the game time is in the midfield.
His opponent follows him inside 50, or he's got a mismatch.
So when he does go forward, he's either dragging a midfielder who's sort of out, or he's getting a defender who has to switch over from someone else.
It's different.
Whereas
if
you go down there,
from
the first minute of the first quarter, someone's going to identify you, watch you. You go into the midfield, come back to the forward, and that guy's going to come find you again.
What was his number, sorry?
So he's been in there for at least 72 minutes this year, so plenty of times a forward. Plus 27.7. So he should be averaging 7.7 rating points per 100 minutes as a forward. But he's actually averaged the 34 point whatever as a forward
which is off the charts.
Well, it is. As I said, number one player in the competition and 10% above. So it's hard.
10% above the next best player.
The best player
in
any position.
And his start to the season should not be glossed over. It's extraordinary, his first three games of this year. And we looked at these numbers, where it sort of ranks in terms of rating points through three games. In the last 15 years, since rating points have been introduced, we've only seen four times has someone had a better three-game start to a to a year.
Aaron Hall in that list?
No, he's not, surprisingly. Dustin Martin in 2017 won a Brownlow. Yeah,
Gary won everything.
Gary Ablett in 2012 was an extraordinary effort. He polled 9 out of 9 Brownlow votes, averaged 42-2 to start that year.
Did he actually?
Yeah. And I believe he was the AFL MVP. Buddy in 2018 was the All-Australian captain. And Patrick Dangerfield in 2017. Well, he actually didn't win anything. That's because he polled 33 Brownlow votes and came second to Martin. So Heaney's next. So he's putting together, yes, it's early. We've only played like 10-12% of the season. But he is on track for something extraordinary at the end of the year.
So how many votes does he have in your Brownlow predictor?
I have him on 7.5. I think he's around 7.8, around there. Yeah, don't think he's 3.33.
Well, he's 28 coaches' votes, which
yeah.
would sort of
it would lean get, it would le- yes, it would be seven would be the fewest he would have, I would think. But his start to the year has been unbelievable, and I think going back to what we were saying, if you're an 8 out of 10, if you're an 8 out of 10 midfielder, or if you play forward, you're a 9 out of 10 forward. I'd rather the 8 out of 10 midfield production, because you're going to be getting the ball at least twice as much throughout the game. Heaney, if he plays for permanent forward when the others come back in, even if he is 10% better than everybody else doing it, he's not getting it anywhere near the amount of the ball. So I think you must... He's got, for the first time, the ability to say, you show us what you can do here. I'm better than everyone else at it. I'm having an unprecedented start to the year. How can you take him out of there now?
I think
you need to find you either need to put Callum Mills at half back.
Yep.
You need to put Luke Parker maybe Luke into Parker like a half forward sort of
has
a role.
Has a decent goal sense.
Yep. Or the alternative is that some people have suggested, Taylor Adams, what happens with him? Does he come in and play? So I think it's crazy to think that Isaac Heaney... I would be surprised and disappointed if he wasn't playing in the midfield for the rest of the year.
John Longmire, you've heard.
I think it would be a waste.
So if you have any complaints at J. Michael's ESPN. any other names that we should need to be keeping an eye on?
Two others. So obviously Luke Jackson, huge game on the weekend. Yep. Just quickly on his game. So he had 20 disposals, 20 hitouts, 10 ground ball gets and 2 goals. Mm-hmm. So if you put those 4 numbers together, only the third time in the last 16 years or 18 years that it's happened. Goldstein did it in 2013 and David Hill 2008. So the ability to sort of get the ball at ground level and hit outs and things like that. But again, just watching since the start of last year, some of these numbers are probably obvious for anyone that's watched for you. As a forward, he's plus 1.6 rating points per 100 minutes.
Pretty
so he's
good.
Okay.
Above
he's above the average, but he's plus 3.9 as a ruckman in that time, which again puts him in sort of the top 5 or 6 ruckman per 100 minutes. Shai Bolton at Richmond's probably another one where they haven't really settled on whether he's a mid forward or is he just a general forward, and how often do we put him in the centre bounce. Just a quick one for me. So plus 1.4 points when he's in the midfield per 100 minutes, plus 3.6 as a forward per 100 minutes. So again, and that's been pretty consistent across his career.
This has been the first 3 games of the year, of the season?
So this includes last year for Shai Bolton. So it's almost, the number's almost twice as good when he's a forward than he's a midfielder.
Same thing again, with it's very similar to Heaney. I think... he's wasted just playing as a forward.
Yeah.
They get so much more benefit. I know that no,
I
number
think they,
won't...
Yeah, I think they, there was talk that he might switch to a 70-30 mid. I think you got to keep him 70 forward and 30 mid.
I think he should, whether maybe not 70, but 60-40. I think he should be at least 50%
in the midfield.
The numbers seem to be the other way for Heaney. So we saw about Heaney being able to sneak forward and get in there, and that's why he boosts his goal. I feel like if Shai Bolton... he's actually getting up there just for a few late centre bounces, and that he might have a bit more value. But if you're trying to put him in there,
it's a totally different dynamic to what's a very stale, slow Richmond midfield.
Again, big call to make for him. I think it's the consistency for him. Yes, he can get you that, but as a genuine midfielder working up and down.
The consistency is hard because he plays in a position that is a half forward is the hardest position.
Yeah, but I'm
to
saying
be
when
consistent.
He's but when, team. But when I'm saying when they put him in as a midfielder, is he really doing the two-way running like a midfielder, or is he still playing as that? I'm in the midfield, but I'm still offensive-minded and I'm still going to attack. So I think that's just the balance that for him. Another one that I looked at is Harry Sheezel. Very early, we don't have enough, again, sort of cut it to minimum minutes when you're going across 2 years. He doesn't have enough minutes in as a midfielder, but I think we all rate this guy as going to be a gun outside midfielder. Just one to watch, he's plus 1.5 rating points per 100 minutes when he plays in defence, plus 3.5% when they're putting plus 3.5 points when they put him as a forward. So Love this guy in front of goal, how he can sort of turn a disposal into a scoring chain for North, and the value of getting him forward as centre has been shown in these numbers, and I think that's what North need to do, whether that's as a midfielder or as just a sort of offensive wingman. His numbers are much better. And then one of the guys we sort of spoke about, maybe something for Craig McRae to look at, Scott Penderbury. So since the start of last year, we got him plus 0.9 points per 100 minutes as a midfielder. So again, above the average, going okay. But in that time that he spent in defence a little bit last year, it was plus 5.1 rating points per 100 minutes. So again, we didn't really deep dive into Collingwood. I sort of said their scores from turnovers and their ability to sort of, their skill in the back half has really let them down this year. Mm. Whether moving Pendlebury behind the ball can help them with their ball
use
movement.
His strength, which is his uncontested ball use.
Well, it's surprising they haven't done that, because it was something that they had done in the past. And given that they are leaking so many points, as we discussed before, it's surprising they haven't put him back there just to sort of try and steady the
ship. Something different, yeah.
Hey, just quickly before we do move on, the intercept mark record, does anyone want it outright?
Don't know.
How many players have a code?
We are now up to 10 players that have done it 12 times. So Liam Jones and Tom Stewart.
10 players have done it 12.
Liam Jones and Tom Stewart have both reached 10 twice, and then we have 8 other players that have done it.
They almost had a duel this weekend.
Was it Darcy Moore last year that had 11 and then you took one off him?
Yes, he took his 11th after the final siren, and the umpire take it off him, but the umpire was the one that didn't, you know, they have to blow a whistle for the mark. He never paid the mark. So, yeah, that one was taken off him. So that ended up being stiff. So I just looked at, is there any other record where you got so many? Because, again, clearances have just got broken by Rowell, and the clearance record is only 21. So it's not a huge range.
Debunked about the...
You've still got one outright leader.
Yeah.
You've got one outright leader in the time that we've been around. I think, again, 99 is what champion data like to call football history. But 14 goals is the most, you know, one person's reached that. I think one person reached a certain amount of hit-outs and tackles. The only other stat that sort of has as many equal leaders is the inside 50. So there's four players with 16 inside 50s.
Okay.
So we have four leaders like Jaden Short, Josh Kelly, Patrick Dangerfield, and Adam Simpson did it back in the day with 16 inside 50s. But
modern names apart from Simpson.
Yes, but 10 equal leaders on intercept marks.
It's not something you can
make it up.
It's not like when you go for like the goal assist record. Like that's very much in your control whether you want to handball it off or kick it to someone or have a shot. Whereas intercept mark, you're relying on
the opposition.
So that's very interesting to see if that gets broken. So it would need to be...
But a lot of those names that are on that, they're all... Most, not that I've seen the list, but I'm pretty sure most of them are currently playing.
Yes, yes. And we spoke about this last year. Intercept marks has gone up through the roof.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly, a lot of them, I think...
I think it'll get broke.
Five or six of the tens have been in the last two or three years.
Yeah, I reckon we'll see an 11-plus this year.
Let's get on whip through a few of these. So we asked the punters on Twitter or X at Footy Tips if you do want to ask some questions as well. We're happy to take them and ask Christian if they wanted to ask anything this week. And there were a few that came through. Let's try and whip through these pretty quickly if we can. Is a rebound 50 inclusive of kickouts from behinds, or is it purely based on an opposition's entry inside 50 and rebounding it out before a behind or a score, asks Anthony.
No, the typical rebound 50 you'll see will include rebounds after a behind. So it's sort of, you know, we don't use rebound 50s too often as an actual raw number, because it's sort of dependent on, he could have conceded a score and just got a rebound from that. So we do look at things like, rebound 50s without a score being conceded and sort of those types of things. But now the raw rebound 50 number you see will just be any time one team's gone into the forward 50 and the other team's been out.
So if you're kicking out, you'll often have more rebound 50s.
Okay. So hang on a second.
Exactly. You talk about stat win percentage. That's the one stat you don't want to. You don't want to win rebound 50s.
Yes.
Because all you're doing is pumping it out of your back line. Just another bugbear of mine is where I have heard comments say, North Melbourne have only had 32 rebound 50s. What? Like, what are you talking about? Like, that is not a number you ever want to control.
But if you kick a point and I take the kick in and boot at 60, is that a rebound 50 to me?
So, yes, it is, in a simple way. Yeah. If you, again, this is a weird, quirky one. If you kick it from within the square, you don't get a kick, and that your team gets the rebound 50. So it's just an old, because the kick in back in the day was always counted a little bit different.
I applaud you for not saying you can't kick 60.
Who?
I'm surprised you didn't say you can't kick 60.
A lot of talk about Nick Dacos and his contested possession numbers. Can you define a contested possession, asks Glenn?
Yeah, so good question. So again, contested possessions are made up of contested marks, so taking a mark with the opposition being able to, a chance to spoil. They're made up of ground ball gets, which is hard ball gets, and loose ball gets. A gather from a hit out, so getting the first possession from a stoppage as a contest possession, and all free kicks, contest possession. So a lot of people like to think of a contest possession is you've got to go in and barrel in under a pack, and there's 35 bodies around the ball. One of the sort of forgotten about contested possessions that's actually highly valuable is the loose ball get, which we spoke about on this. So picture a kick going inside 50 and a spoil happens. Whoever wins it at ground level gets a contested possession.
Regardless of how much pressure they're
under. So you could be 30 metres in the clear. So what a contested possession is basically means is the ball wasn't meant for you. It wasn't passed for you.
Yeah.
It was available for anyone to get to. So
that's a good way.
Again, loose ball get, the best way when we're trying to define a loose ball get is right place, right time. Yeah. You just happen to be running past and scooped up the ball.
And so, even though you might not technically be contested in terms of there might not be anyone within 5 metres of you, it's a contested possession.
Yes.
Because the ball's in contest.
I can see a lot of people, and you can watch it. A Paddy Cripps contested possession might look very different to a Nick Daicos contested possession, but they're both as valuable because the ball was up for grabs at either team could have got it there.
Joel asks, how is clearance efficiency evaluated and what defines the stoppage area?
Well, stoppage area, you need vision for that. Exactly, that's okay. I did joke this morning, it's the vibe. It's like the castle, but stoppage area, it'll change by stoppage. You can sort of see it. It's very easy to tell on the vision.
If it trickles out a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll use it from when the throw up or the throw in happens, where the players are, you can sort of see where the space starts to get created from that. So very easy to centre bounce. Basically, it's the square. So because only four people are out in the square, if you can get it outside of the square, that's sort of that's the stoppage area being cleared. Or is that a throw in and a ball up? It all depends on team structures. Clearance efficiency, we tag all turnovers. So we have either a turnover in general play or a turnover from a clearance. So clearance efficiency is just looking at all your clearance chains and whether you turn the ball over coming out of the stoppage. So again, you could have a clearance where you have four handballs, it's all effective, but then the final kick of that chain might go out in the full.
It's an ineffective clearance.
That would be a clearing turnover. Yeah, exactly that. It's an ineffective clear. It's a clearance. Right. You've won
so
the
even
clearance,
though the initial chain being like started would be effective.
You've won the stoppage. You've got the ball moving your way out of the stoppage. But you ended up turning it over either with a bad kick or a turnover. So again, I think clearance efficiency, it's about 70 to 80%. So most clearances, you're going to maintain possession further down the field. But we do, we record all turnovers and just say whether they were in general play or out of a clearance.
This one's from one of your mates. You pass this on to me. So you guys talk about expected score versus actual score a lot. And my question is, are these metrics often higher in the beginning of the season versus the end of the season? Another way of looking at it is, do tired legs at the end of the season result in worse accuracy when having shots at goal? And then just tacking on to the end of that, what about in game, like quarter one to quarter four, is accuracy better than expected earlier because they're fresher and then get worse as the game goes on? I mean, I guess, two-part question, the overall season and then within a game.
So the season, looked at the season, it's a little bit random. I mean, if you look at the easiest shots, if you wanted to. So the highest expected accuracy across a round, so this is going back to 2010 and looking at all rounds, is round 20. So in round 20, across the past 13 years or so, teams are expected to score at 49.5%. So getting pretty high quality shots. So that's round 20. The lowest quality shots are coming in round 18. 2 weeks earlier, so 47.9%. So
this year you might find that it's round two and round eight. Yeah. Like it could be.
So it's quite high for round one, two, and three, but round four is one of the bottom five sort of accuracy. Yeah. So very, very random. One thing I did look at though is exactly that. You look at your expected accuracy, but you might have every team kicking above the expected accuracy for one round, or every team kicking below. There is actually a 5 week period, round 13 to round 17, where teams continually kick below the competition average. With round 17 really coming to a head, where teams are at negative 2.1% below their expected shot accuracy.
How many years is this data? Is this taking into
13 or 14 years?
2.1% unders.
Is that?
Yeah,
is
and that's all. So round 17
seventh stretch
somehow. So as I said, it starts in round 13. So round 12, most teams are in the positive, are kicking it above expected. Round 13, they're below. Round 14, below. Round 15, they're at least a 1% below, which is quite a big drop. Round 16, 0.5%, and then round 17, 2%.
It almost mirrors the fatigue factor that I think
the
footy fans
the
in general feel as well.
And by round that, the lack of interest like, around you know,
round 13 to 17,
good,
to it's the middle of June, July.
You know who's good, you know who's bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Interesting theory. What about
so season's very, very random. Again, looking at finals, though, it's very hard. Home and away comes out at 0.0 because, as I said, with expected scoring, it's taking into account every single shot from that part of the ground, including your own.
Yep.
So if you're trying to look at the whole competition across home and away average, it's like, well, that is what you're expected. You know, if your team's kicking at 49% across the home and away season, that's going to be your expected average. So that doesn't change for home and away. But in finals, it does drop negative 2.1%, which is similar to the round 17 number I gave
more
you.
More pressure, so it would be the biggest drop. Fatigue. Off.
Exactly. And this is, it's not so much more pressure on the ball carry, because that would be taken into account for the, you know,
okay,
so that
yep.
the shot, it's, yeah. mental, it's pressure. The mental pressure, yeah, the mental pressure that you're talking
the
about.
The situation
yeah.
of the game.
The situation of the game, exactly, rather than
what about
shots.
Quarter by quarter?
And this is the one. So I kind of knew when I saw the query, I thought, oh, it's going to come up so random during the season. I was surprised to see that 5-week period where it drops every week. But now it certainly stacks up for just within a game. So quarter one, we see probably the lowest quality of shots in quarter one. So 48% is expected hit rate. So whether defences are defending stronger and teams are just getting harder shots, or just not sort of breaking it open. But they're scoring at plus 0.7% across the first quarter. So okay. harder shots, but scoring above accuracy.
Yep.
Quarter two, 49.2% is your expected accuracy. So as I said, 48% in the first quarter, 49.2%. So shots are getting a little bit easier in the second quarter, and teams are plus 0.3, so they're doing okay. Third quarter, we're at 49.4% is the expected accuracy, and teams are at plus 0.5. Last quarter's 48.9% is the expected accuracy, and teams are scoring at 48%, which is negative 0.9.
The, so only, the only quarter with a negative
is the last quarter.
Well, I think that it kind of makes sense. So there's two things. I think one is obviously you're fatigued. There's the fatigue, tired factor. And then the other thing is, you know, especially games, because that's factoring in all games.
Talking about the finals effect.
Close games, there's more pressure. There's
not physical pressure.
Far more pressure, mental pressure to kick the goal when it's a tight game in the fourth quarter than there is in the first or second quarter.
Again, I love that query when you sort of run it and you go, yes, there is something in it. So, yeah, fourth quarters is,
We've got to wrap things up very quickly. We've got a few more things to get through, though. Firstly, so red time on Wednesday this week. Because of the...
Will be Wednesday, but I...
You're away.
Well, I thought we were still releasing it on Thursday.
Oh, are we? Oh, you'll find out whenever the podcast goes.
Yeah, but it'll be Wednesday or Thursday.
Jared and Jake are back for that, so keep an eye for that. Jake, are you riding off the Crows? 0-2. Start of the year has been very poor, riddled with, like, their entries inside 50 on the weekend especially were abysmal for what they have in that forward line. The midfield seems a bit one-paced, a bit boring. Understrength backline, obviously some injuries in the preseason. Finals still on the cards because their upcoming schedule, I'm looking at it.
It's tough.
Frio away, and they've been horrific away from home.
Then the D's in Gather Round.
Then Carlton away, and then Essendon. That could be 1-5.
Yeah, well, they need to win this weekend. I think that's pretty clear. But when you say riding them off, what are we talking
finals.
About?
Finals was their break even this year.
They must win this weekend then. Because it's hard to see them beating Melbourne over there. I know they beat Carlton in I think it was the opener to Gather Round last year. They played really well. But you can't... We just spoke about Collingwood. So if we're going to write Collingwood off at 0-3 or 0-4, how can we say Adelaide's going to be able to
their
do what they can't
different
do?
To what Collingwood
I understand, but I just think Adelaide, there are too many... There are still concerns with for me, in the midfield. Just not enough... depth in that midfield, even with Dawson, even with Laird. I just think the fall off, it's too stark. The entries that they're getting inside 50, they're not resulting in enough shots at goal. They're not able to take marks inside forward 50. There are still too many issues with that side, and I don't know if they can fix that in a short period of time. Would I be surprised if they beat Fremantle? Absolutely not, because I don't think Freo is as good as advertised either at this moment. They've had their own issues as well. They've played Brisbane, and we really are unsure about what the lines are like. And then they didn't really... I mean, they won against North, but they didn't really...
Well, they let themselves
dug a hole for themselves.
Tale of two halves. That first half is completely North,
Going back to what you said right at the top of the show, we don't have enough of a sample size on any of these teams yet to make any grand sweeping statements.
No.
But they'll want to win this week. Yes. Being 0-3 and facing the D's... as you said, you rattled off the teams they're playing. It's not out of the question they could be 1-6, and then it is 100% over. They need to win this week.
So some of the warning stats, they're number one for inside 50 so far, so 60 per game, which is the equal number one. But they've only scored from 30% of those. So they're ranked last for that. Last for marks inside 50.
So that's it. So they're getting that's so
overall efficiency is just offensive efficiency 64.1%, 17th. So they're just
so how can you be the best inside 50 team and take the fewest marks? It doesn't make sense. You're getting the most opportunity.
They had the wet game in the Gold Coast, which drags his number down. But again, the reason sort of looked at these is this was their one strength area last year. So again, go back to Sydney and Collingwood. We'll talk about just little increments in all parts of the game. Adelaide, the defense wasn't great. Their midfield was okay. Their midfield still got okay in the first 2 weeks, contested possessions wise, wasn't it? It was their forward line last year. They were the second best scoring team behind Brisbane. They were, as you said, third best for offensive efficiency, which is just balls in your forward half and you're being able to score from it. They've dropped to bottom three nearly every stat so far. So they get it. They get sort of around.
Who's their third best midfielder?
It's a great question.
Matt Crouch?
It's currently Matt Crouch.
Yeah. And Matt Crouch wasn't.
Laird hasn't
team.
hasn't been setting the world on fire, I don't think.
No, but Matt Crouch wasn't in the team. Wasn't even. He was like
Sandful, halfway out the door.
So I think that's still there. And I know midfield for me is a big thing. I still think they're too short in the midfield.
Is the hype justified or is it hyperbole? We've got a couple of these just before we wrap things up. I know we're running short on time. Christian, Jared Witts is the Suns' most important player. In 30 seconds or less.
No, he's not their most important player. But again, we look at that one injury for them. That was the second most costly. Again, we look at costs, injury costs. So if you leave the team, how much does your replacement player average? So it's very, it's always going to be more costly to lose a ruckman. Nick Natanui was always a high cost for West Coast because they didn't have a backup ruck some of those years. Jack Sinclair, he missed, 1 week. It was 9.3 rating points between him and his replacement player. Jared Witts was the second most this year at 8.5.
But does it depend who your replacement player is?
Yes. So Lockie Neal was 8.4 and things like that. So it's the next midfielder in. So we know all your ratings. So again, I'd have to double check. I think it's based on Ned Moyle coming in or it's just based on how much he is ahead of the second ruckman.
So if Lockie Neal was going out and they said, Hugh McLuggage missed last week, he's coming back in, then that gap wouldn't be as much as if...
No. It'll still be... It's still looking at best 22. So your best 22 should be Neil and McCluggage in there. When you take McCluggage out, how much rating points you're actually losing when you take Neil out. So it's just, again, it just because you can have injuries, but not every injury actually costs you your best 22. Port have three guys injured at the moment who haven't played a game and probably not part of the best 22. But quick answer. He's valuable.
He's valuable, but
Who is their most valuable then?
Again, I think it's... midfielders. It's a Noah Anderson, Took Miller and things like that. I think I have more value to...
Matty Rowell?
Jake, Taylor Adams will be this year's Brody Grundy and not find a permanent home in the Sydney midfield.
I don't think so. I think he will play. We touched on this a little before. I think they will play him.
And they'll find a spot for him.
And they will find a spot for him. And I think, interestingly, of the Parker, Mills, Adams trio, got there eventually, expected to come back in. I think the one of those three that's most likely to play midfield is Adams. I think they can find a spot for Parker half forward. I think they can find a spot for Mills off half back. Yeah. I think Adams is quite suited to playing. I know Collingwood tried playing him a bit.
Well, he was Collingwood's only mid forward last year.
Yeah,
but he didn't come to Sydney to play midfield.
Exactly. I think it's more likely he will play in the midfield. Goulden will go back to a wing. Warner is spending more time playing a bit more as a mid-forward, more pushing into the forward 50. And then you, as I said before, I think you've got to leave Isaac Keeney in the midfield.
All right, 15-second answer, Christian. Luke Jackson and Sean Darcy can play in the same team together. We just talked about Jackson's dominance.
I don't think
so.
The one stat for me, Jackson's game was enormous. It was so good to watch. 6 kicks and 18 handballs. That is not someone I can put in 30 metres from goal.
So what happens to Sean Darcy?
Maybe the question is Sean Darcy going to be the Brody Grundy?
Well, there you go. That wraps things up for today. I know that we had a lot to get through. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Don't forget Red Time Thursday. Probably Thursday. I don't know.
It'll be Thursday.
And to everyone at home, we'll speak to you in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.